Right. Thanks, Singer Matty. Hello, everybody. Well, I think the impetus for the talk was, you know, Singer Matty wanted local order members to come and sort of introduce themselves and do something on one of these Sangha nights. And she also had the theme, you know, up until, is it the whole year? The whole theme for the whole year is Sangha. So I thought, well, I'll as a way of introducing myself, I'll give a talk on what the Sangha means to me. And I didn't know what I'd taken on. In some ways, it's easier to give a talk on why I'm a Buddhist for me, but you know what the Sangha means to me has really challenged me. I think because I got involved with the Sri Ratna Buddhist community when I was quite young and unformed. I had to do a lot of my growing up within the Sangha. And as you probably know, growing up isn't always, it can be quite painful. And you know, I've had quite a few experiences within the Sangha where, you know, things have been really difficult. So I think it brings me up against that. Although, you know, saying that, I don't regret any of it. You know, I think the growing pains have been well worthwhile. And my overall sense is, I'm deeply grateful for coming across the Friends of the Western Buddhist Order, or the Sri Ratna Buddhist community as it is now. Anyway, I'm taking a sort of launch pad for the talk. I listened to one of Sangharakshita's tape lectures a few years ago now. I was at a loose end, I think, when I was living at Guhyaloka. Guhyaloka is quite a good place to be at loose end because you haven't got Wi-Fi, you haven't got television, you haven't got radio. But I did have all of Sangharakshita's talks on my iPod. So I did one of those things where you just whiz the wheel around and see where it landed. And I thought, well, I'll go with that. And the title of the talk was The Meaning of Spiritual Community, which is a talk I was sort of fairly familiar with, but listening to the introduction of it, it sort of grabbed me. He threw out these questions about what the spiritual community or Sangha is. The questions were, you know, who are the members of the spiritual community? Where do you find the spiritual community? And particularly, what do members of the spiritual community do? What do they do for themselves? What do they do for each other? And what do they do for the world? And I was particularly grabbed by, I wanted to know what I'm supposed to be doing for myself. Maybe it's my own self-interest, but I thought, well, what's Sangharakshita got to say about this? You know, what is he going to sort of pinpoint? What is it we do? You know, what is it as members of the spiritual community we do for ourselves? And he threw this question out, a bit like I'm doing, and it was a long time before he got to answering it. But he sort of planted a seed, and I kept going, what's he going to say about what we do for ourselves? Or what the spiritual community does for us? What do we as members of a spiritual community do that benefits ourselves? So that's the main bit I want to talk about, but I'll address the other question first, maybe more briefly. So who are the members of the spiritual community? Who are the members of the Sangha? As you probably know, there's quite a pyramid of the Sangha. There's the Arya Sangha, which are those which have attained some sort of transcendental wisdom. They're the ones we can really rely on because they've got wisdom. And then there's the, coming down the pyramid, there's those who have committed themselves, there's those who have been ordained as Buddhists. They've committed their lives to the three jewels, they've committed themselves to the Sangha. But then, in the much broader sense, it's all Buddhist practitioners. It's everybody who's, if you like, trying to make an effort to grow and develop within the context of some sort of Buddhist community. So basically, you know, the Sangha is all of us. In coming here tonight, you know, we are members of a Sangha. And where you find members of the Sangha is when they are engaged in some sort of spiritual practice. Whenever committed or, you know, people who are interested and desiring to grow as individuals come together, well, there you find a Sangha. Which may be thinking, in some ways it's an atmosphere we create through coming together as individual practitioners. There's some sort of atmosphere we generate through doing things together like meditating, discussing the Dharma, developing friendships, doing devotional practices, a sort of atmosphere that's created which enables us to thrive and develop more. I was also thinking it's quite connected to the way the Brahmaviharas are talked about. The Brahmaviharas are talked about, well, Vihara is a dwelling. So they're talked about as places we can actually dwell. The Brahmaviharas being metta, which we're all familiar with. I know some of you are familiar with the other ones, mudita, sympathetic joy, karuna, compassion, and upeksha, equanimity. But I think it's not only a place we can individually dwell in these positive emotions, but collectively it's an atmosphere we generate. So it's a sort of atmosphere which permeates, how we come together. So I think one of the characteristics of a Sangha, how I see it, is that's where you experience these positive emotions. We delight in one another, we rejoice in one another. Very often just seeing somebody, you get a sort of lift out of it, because obviously there's something shining through them. And over time you can see people blossom more and more. I particularly noticed this, when I lived at a retreat centre. People arrive on a Friday, looking a bit worn from their busy city lives. And then come the Sunday, even if it was just a weekend, people visibly sort of blossomed and started shining. So they do that through participating in this atmosphere, which is created whenever we, as members of the Sangha, come together and engage in these practices and talk about what is most meaningful to us. So that's where we find the Sangha. We find the Sangha whenever we come together on the basis of collective practice. So now for this sort of question, what do members of the spiritual community do for themselves? Well, he first of all highlighted, in some ways something which is quite obvious. We engage with our own personal development. We engage with our own meditation practice. We engage with our own mind. We engage with the cultivation of positive emotion. We engage with the cultivation of metta. That's what we do as members of the spiritual community. We engage, as best we can with our own unfoldment, our own growth. Another thing he highlighted, what we do, we come together on the basis of our deepest aspiration, our aspiration to grow as individuals. That's how we also relate to one another. And that's quite a challenge in itself, that we don't relate on the basis of our common, as it were, more superficial interests. We don't come together on the basis of liking the same music or supporting the same football team or living in the same area. We come together on the basis of what is deepest within us, what we aspire to become. And we try and relate to each other on that basis. And that can be quite a challenge, because you, in the Sangha, you come across people who you don't necessarily initially gel with. You probably come across people who rub you up the wrong way, or you may dislike even. Or you come across people from different cultures where there isn't the same sort of common ground. And the challenge is to, how can one relate to that other person on this basis of this shared idealism, the shared commitment to a spiritual ideal? How does one do that? I must admit, I found that quite a challenge at times. It was only recently, I think, we had a convention last year when the most Indian order members ever had been brought over. I think there were 70 of them, something like that. And for the first time, I actually managed to sort of connect. Before, I always found, they come from such a different background. Now, you can make sort of superficial niceties and be pleasant and so on, but I didn't feel that same resonance. But I had the good fortune to be in a study group where, us Westerners were outnumbered by the Indians. And I think that was my best experience, coming together in a study group and discussing the Dharma and them sharing more and more their experience. I did feel more that resonance. But, even in our Western Sangha, I look around sometimes and I think, why don't they just go somewhere else? I find them really difficult. Or, I look around and say, God, what a bunch of weirdos. You know, that can be an initial sense, but so it's not always there. I must admit this ability in me that, you know, you come together on the basis of a shared common idealism, a shared commitment to the same spiritual ideal. You know, I've arrived on especially big order gatherings, and you know, as I approach the place, I think, what the hell am I doing here? You know, spending my time with this bunch. But you know, once I get over that initial resistance, you know, I find, you know, well, that's where I want to be. These are my people. These are my tribe, if you like. These are the people I really resonate with. What's deepest in me really resonates with these people, because they're also embodying something that I share. But then, yeah, the bit in the talk which really got me was, you know, what we do as members of the spiritual community, what we do for ourselves, is we put ourselves in a context where we can be ourselves fully and at our best. And I had that, yes, no, that's what I really appreciate. I certainly wouldn't have experienced myself, you know, as I've, you know, had glimpses of over the years, without the help and encouragement and the context of this particular Sangha. It's very easy to find places where you can be yourself. Now, usually we associate being ourselves with sort of letting it all out and letting out our vices. Well, it's quite easy, I think, to find context where you can let out your vices. I remember in Italy, when I lived in Italy for a while, that was very much part of the culture, that, you know, that you're encouraged to indulge your vices. It was seen as being quite good for you. So very often, you know, if you had a vice, you were encouraged to express it and live it out. But so it's quite easy. I mean, even in our culture now, you can find places where you can be yourself, you know, in your, let out your vices or let out your peccadillos, whatever they may be. But a context where you can experience your highest aspirations, I think, is quite rare. And where you can meet other people who share that similar aspiration. And Sangharaksha makes the point that in doing that, we can greatly accelerate our own spiritual development. It's very difficult, I think, to do this growth lark on your own. We need a context where we can embody what is deepest and most precious to us. And when we do that, and are also sparked off by others doing a similar thing, well, it brings it out even more and strengthens it. Because I think a lot of the time, the shoots of our own growth are quite, well, they are like baby shoots. You know, they can easily get trampled on. They can easily be, you know, shut down again. But a context which really encourages them to grow and blossom is very, very precious. And I think that's, you know, one of the things I really appreciate about having a context to live out my spiritual life, is I can be myself at my best. Be myself at my fullest, my deepest. So that's what Sangharaksha sort of pinpointed, you know, what we do for ourselves by putting ourselves in that context where we can be fully ourselves. The process of our own growth is accelerated, and those of others around us is also accelerated, because we take part in a collective process where what is best in us is reinforced and rejoiced in and acknowledged and met, if you like. And you know, what we do for each other, you know, in some ways is more obvious, that we help each other in any way we can. Sometimes that's materially, sometimes somebody needs a hand moving house, somebody needs a hand, you know, maybe with money for a certain period. So we look after each other, you know, people who are ill, you know, we aspire to look after them. I noticed last week there was a card going around for somebody who was ill. And I think that's a lovely aspect of the Sangha, that if somebody's not present, they're not out of mind. They are born in mind, and we still care and nourish them by thinking of them. And so when I last gave a talk here, I talked, you know, quite at length about, you know, my experience of going through cancer treatment, and the support I got from the Sangha going through that illness really made a difference. As I mentioned there, I got hundreds of cards. You know, regularly, you know, when the postman came, there was a big thump on the doormat, and there were all these cards, some of them from people I had never even met, but they'd responded to, you know, a message going out on the order, you know, email. And all these cards started arriving, hundreds of them. And it really made a difference in the sense that I was aware that the people out there were really rooting for me, who really cared about me. And the sort of flip side of that for me was I really felt I had to do my best to meet this challenge as best I could. There were people out there, you know, thinking of me, and my response was, well, I have to do my best as well. I have to try and get through this as best I can. So that made a hell of a difference. So I thought I'd try and communicate a bit more of, you know, my sort of career in the Sangha and talk about some of the difficult bits as well. Because now, in some ways, that experience of when I had cancer was one of my most positive experiences of the sort of collective Sangha being, well, the first time I experienced it as a refuge. Very often we speak of the three refuges, the three jewels, but for the first time I really experienced the Sangha as being a refuge, and it really sort of nourished me and held me and supported me. I've had times in my life where I've hit difficulties, and I think partly it's my own fault. You know, it gets so difficult, I sort of withdraw, and I don't, or I reach out maybe to the wrong people in the wrong way, and I don't necessarily find the support I want. And that can be very painful. But that experience of going through cancer treatment, I really felt, you know, the Sangha really met me and supported me and carried me through it. But yeah, going back to the beginnings of my involvement with Tree Ratna, as it was in Manchester, which was quite a small centre at the time. It was in a semi-detached house in the suburbs. And it was all a bit subversive. We didn't even have planning permission for it to be a Buddhist centre. So, you know, you came across this address. There was no sign outside saying Manchester Buddhist Centre. And it was very small. You know, the Sangha was maybe 20, 25 people. But they still were a very close-knit bunch. And I remember when I first went along there, I was terrified of, you know, going to a Buddhist centre and meeting these weird Buddhists. But what I met was, you know, people who seemed really genuinely interested in me. You know, right from the off. I mean, I was a bit suspicious at first. Maybe I was a bit tarnished by my experience of other people who seemed to be, you know, very willing and interested in you. I thought, you know, what are they after? But after a while, my sort of trust built up. They seemed to be a genuine interest in my well-being and welfare. And I realised, you know, inside I realised, well, that's the sort of relationship I wanted, that I'd been looking for. And yeah, it was quite a close-knit, small Sangha. But I was doing a catering degree at the time, and we had to do a year out working in industry. And I found out that the Croydon Buddhist Centre had a restaurant. So I got in touch with them, and I arranged to do my industrial release, as it was called, working in Hockney's restaurant down in Croydon. And it was a bit, I was still very new to things. I'd only done a couple of retreats, and you know, I sort of built up a certain degree of confidence, but I was still quite, you know, green, shy, unformed human being. And I went down there, and I realised I sort of jumped in the deep end. The Croydon Buddhist Centre at that time had a reputation of one of the most intensive situations in the movement. It's described in, I was looking at everywhere, this the Tree Ratna story, Vajragupta's book, because he describes Croydon very well. But one of the phrases he used, it was a pressure cooker, and the heat was turned up high. So I found myself in a community of 20 odd men, sharing a room with three others. So the four of us in a room, there were only three beds. I think I was the new one, so I slept on the floor. And we all worked together in the restaurant. At that time, the situation was really growing and expanding. They were building a new reception area out the back of the restaurant and had started running arts events. And the new reception area was going to, when it was completed, it was going to be the launch of the art centre, the Croydon Art Centre. And by chance, they had very good premises right on the high street. So it's very different to Manchester, you know, in a quiet suburban street. It was right on the high street, three-storey building, two businesses there, a whole food shop and a restaurant with a Buddhist centre stroke art centre out the back. And lots of people passing every day, you know, lots of footfall. And the place was just booming. It was really taking off. You know, the restaurant was taking more and more money each week. Arts events were starting to be attended. And you know, we worked, you know, we're a bunch of mainly, you know, young people in their 20s, highly idealistic. But the main thing it seemed to embody that, you know, we were changing the world. You know, we're really impacting the world. But through being on the high street, you know, Buddhism was very visible. We were very upfront, you know, we were a Buddhist centre and, you know, the businesses were run by Buddhists. And we worked very hard. We led a life where, you know, we sort of eat, slept, drank Buddhism. You know, we worked together, you know, long hours, heavily reliant on one another as a team. I mean, the restaurant wasn't very well designed to be geared up for waiter service, but shortly before I got there, they started opening the evening with waiter service, and the restaurant was on three levels. We had the kitchen in the basement, servery on the ground floor, and the restaurant on the first floor. So practically it was a disaster, but we really had to pull together as a team and be in good communication, or else it didn't work. And it required a lot of running up and down stairs. I don't think I've ever been so fit. So we worked long hours, and then quite a few of us, you know, we ran home at night, and then we'd set, you know, our alarms. 8 hours after we got back, we'd be in the shrine room meditating. Although, one nice thing I remember about that time as well, there was always somebody was assigned to go around with tea half an hour before. So it was a lovely sense of, you know, we were really supporting each other in our practice. And there was a great sense of camaraderie and teamwork, and, you know, this idealism that we were really affecting the world. But the Croydon Centre is what it also described as one of the centres that, you know, went badly wrong. You know, there was all this idealism and expansion, and we were making lots of money. But it all got a bit, I mean, it was very difficult to describe. I think Vajragupta in his book, The Tree Ratna Story, sort of sums it up quite well. I still find it quite difficult to sum up what happened. But it became more of a group than a spiritual community. And it sort of demanded tremendous loyalty to the situation. And a lot of it was inspired and kept up and running by a very charismatic chairman who seemed to have a particular quality of really sort of developing connections with each and everybody within the community. And we all loved him, you know, in many ways. We loved him and aspired to be like him. He was a sort of a role model for many of us. I remember Padma Vajra, who's a, you know, very senior and respected order member these days, he said to me one day, "We all want to be like Padmaraja." You know, he was the ideal. He was where he was at. He seemed so creative and positive and inspired. But it all got a bit intoxicating, I think. I think he got a bit intoxicated because we were so successful. There was this general view that, you know, we were the best Buddhist centre. You know, we were where it's at. I remember I really sort of fed it, you know, bought into that. I had this sense, you know, in coming across Buddhism, I'd found something incredibly valuable that really seemed to bring the best out in me. And here I was in the best possible situation I could be. And we were the ones who were really doing it. We were the ones who were really at the cutting edge of, you know, transforming the world, creating this new society. We were the ones who were really doing it. So, you know, I think I was assigning, you know, it was a certain intoxication that we were, you know, quite isolated from the rest of the movement. And quite a few people were quite critical of some of the things that were going on, and rightly so. So, but you know, our response to that, oh, they're just jealous, you know, because we're the ones who are really doing it. Anyway, it all came to an end, you know, mainly through, you know, order members and outside the situation putting pressure on, and eventually people within the situation seeing that, although there was many things that were good about it, but a lot was flawed. But it was very painful, I think, for many of us who were involved with it, because, you know, I was still quite new and quite young, and my life there had been better than it ever had been before. And I think for the first time in my life, I really trusted people, and I really trusted something that I could really put myself into very wholeheartedly, and, you know, start to express, you know, what was deepest in me, which was still, you know, quite young and unformed. So it was very painful for me when all that came crashing down. So, you know, an experience of Sangha, which was very, very painful. And, you know, I found myself I was managing the evening team of the restaurant when all this happened. And after things changed, it was just anarchy. I'd taken on the management role, and before it all worked quite smoothly because everybody sort of followed the leader, and we all were very loyal to the situation and sort of towed the party line. But once everything changed, it was anarchy. And trying to manage it was really hard. You know, in some way, I worked a lot harder post what's termed the revolution than I did before. And I sort of worked myself into the ground. And because after a while, I realised the basis on why I was doing it was shattered. I sort of lost the ground on which it was based on. So I got ill, and I was ill for about 7 years with this chronic fatigue syndrome. Or in some way, it was very akin to depression. And, you know, understandably, I withdrew quite a bit. And I didn't really find anybody able to help me. I was going through somewhat of a spiritual crisis. And I think I sort of realised later, it sort of reinforced a deep-rooted nihilism in me. That for a while I thought I'd found something really worth living for, that I could really trust and give myself to wholeheartedly. And because it went pear-shaped, it seemed to confirm, well, there you go, there's nothing really worth living for. There's nothing that really embodies, you know, my highest aspirations. So it's very, very painful. And you know, for quite a period, I couldn't really find. Well, I wanted to die. I didn't get to the point where I was seriously wanting to commit suicide. But each day I woke up, and I just thought, I want to die. And that carried on for weeks and months. And it was about 6 months. I was just in a very dark place. But I mainly held on to Sangharakshita during that time. There was something about the way he presented the Dharma, which I still believed in. And I sort of kept a thread going by, I just carried on listening to Sangharakshita. And I found hearing him, you know, teach the Dharma just very comforting. And eventually I found, you know, one of the order members I first met in Manchester, he really reached out to me and, you know, was able to give me the help I needed. So I often think, you know, I'm lucky to be here, and I wouldn't be here if I hadn't had the help of other members of the Sangha in that period. In some ways, that was a lot harder than going through cancer. That was the most painful period of my life, because I did feel quite isolated and withdrawn and cut off from people. And certain members of the Sangha had really hurt me. You know, I turned to them for help, and for various reasons, they hadn't been able to help me. I was once even told by quite a senior order member that I should just go elsewhere. You know, I should go and get myself a life outside of the movement. He said to me, I don't know what you're hanging around for, you know, go elsewhere. And I found that very painful as well. You know, he was somebody I turned to for help. So I think that's why, you know, when I talk about what the Sangha means to me, it sort of brings me up again, well, that was really, really painful. But at the same time, I think it helped me clarify, well, what was I doing sticking around? And, you know, still inside there was a connection I'd made, you know, a deeper connection, especially with, you know, the Dharma as taught by Sangharakshita. And then eventually I did find members of the Sangha who were able to help and support me. And in some ways I realised it made me more determined. This did mean something to me. It was really important to me. And I sometimes think, that's how I got the name Vajra. But when I was ordained, I was given the name Vajra, which is a diamond thunderbolt. And it's said to have the qualities of the diamond that it's indestructible. And the person who ordained me sort of pointed out that, you know, I'd been through, you know, a lot of difficulties and so on, and I'd just kept going. You know, I'd never given up, and I'd shown great determination. So in some ways, I sort of thank that period that, well, it made me a Vajra. And I was delighted to be a Vajra. I think a lot of us boys, we aspire to be Vajras. And I certainly didn't think I was going to be a Vajra. I thought, if anything, I'm going to be a Lotus. But I was given the name Vajra. And that was, you know, maybe that sort of links me on to the next story. Very positive experience of Sangha was my ordination retreat. Coming together with a group of guys, there were 14 of us, living together for 14 months on retreat together with this common thing, you know, thing in common that we're all going to get ordained. And I think a lot of people find, not everybody, I mean, some people really struggle on their ordination retreat, but for me it was a real heavenly period, if you like. It was a real peak experience in my life. And it certainly made, you know, again, all those periods where I'd really gone through it worthwhile. I just loved, you know, being out in Spain for 4 months on retreat, preparing to be ordained, getting very excited about, you know, what name I would get, getting very excited about being introduced to my Buddha or Bodhisattva that I was going to meditate on. Because I don't know if you all know that when we're ordained, we take up a meditation practice on a particular Buddha or Bodhisattva. It's not spoken of so much these days in terms of initiation, but there was that thing that, you know, you're going to be initiated, and it's all magic and mystery. So that, you know, that was a real peak experience. And I was told then that, you know, the people you're ordained with, well, you know, you're going to have a special bond with them for the rest of your life. And that's certainly be my experience too. A couple of years ago we had a 20th reunion retreat, which was, I think, very special because we were all there, all the ones of us that are still alive and still in the order, we were all there. Whereas when we had a 10th reunion, quite a few of us weren't there because they were a bit out of sorts with things. But it seemed very special just coming together, all of us were there. And again, I noticed that, you know, when we come together, there is a sort of magic bond between us, and something of the atmosphere of that retreat is reignited, and once more we seem to dwell back in the secret valley as freshly ordained members of the Triratna Buddhist Order. So that's very much part of what the Sangha means to me, is that sort of connection I have with the people I was ordained with, and some of them, you know, are still the best friends I have. And a lot of it is rooted in, we have that shared experience of being ordained together. We are sort of brothers, if you like, in the order. What else to say about that? Just to underline, yeah, the public ordination is... Well, at the time, I think, you know, you tend to get focused on the private ordination, because at the private ordination, you get your name and you get your initiation. But the public ordination seems to sort of pass you by in a bit of a blur. But the public ordination is very important, because that's where I emphasise that, you know, you're not just getting, you know, ordained on your own. You're joining an order. You're joining an order of committed Buddhists. And for me, you know, over the years, that's, you know, seems to be more and more important, that I'm coming together with others on the basis of a shared ideal, and coming together in harmony with others and united with others, And to that extent, it embodies, again, this desire that I want to change the world. And I do see the Sangha as, you know, being the best way of doing that. I mean, I know, you know, we have all kinds of failings, and in some ways we're not doing that much, and the world's problems are still, you know, in some ways far greater than, you know, what we're doing to counterbalance them. But I still believe that, you know, as a whole, the order is a force for good in the world. You know, we're doing what we can to, you know, improve people's lives. We're doing what we can to live out this ideal that we're working on ourselves so we can be of greater benefit to others. The altruistic dimension is, you know, again, you know, one of my sort of deepest values, that I want to be able to make a contribution to the world. And of course, you know, if you're united with others, well, that contribution can be so much more, can be so much more effective. It's certainly long gone is the intoxication that a small group of us can, you know, really make a difference. We can only make a difference, you know, the more of us there are. I mean, I still think that, you know, what the world needs is some way that we can unite, you know, some sort of principle that can bring human beings together on the basis of what is best in them, not on the basis of this sort of, you know, violence and hatred and antagonism, and, you know, human beings pitting themselves against other human beings, you know, in a fight for what, you know. So yeah, that was, you know, a very positive experience of Sangha, you know, being on my ordination retreat and joining an order, you know, joining a force for good in the world. And then, yeah, my life as an order member, yeah, as I mentioned earlier, I had the opportunity to live at a retreat centre. I lived at a retreat centre down in Sussex, first of all, called Rivendell. And again, that was, you know, one of my highlights of being a member of a group of people doing something very worthwhile together. I remember I'd first been invited, you know, to be a member of a team running a retreat as a mitra, and I thought, what an honour. You know, I was there with four or five people putting on a retreat, and just being part of that team and being able to make a contribution to something, you know, which I believe is so worthwhile. I remember, you know, it's just a real hit to me that, you know, this is what I want to be doing. I want to be, maybe it's the reason why I love team sports so much. You know, the team is quite a, you know, an ideal for me, that, you know, as somebody mentioned earlier, that the sum of the parts being greater than the individuals, you know, contributing and working together in harmony with others. You sort of create an atmosphere which is greater than the sum of the parts. And it's great putting on a retreat. I've got, you know, great faith in retreats. That's, you know, plug for the retreat at Easter. It's such a worthwhile thing to help put on. People, you know, they can be life-changing, and people really get a lot out of them, even if it's just a break and a nourishment from their everyday lives. People usually leave the retreats, you know, better than they arrived, usually having gained something. Yes, so that was, you know, after ordination, it's one of my first experiences of sort of finding my feet as an order member was at Rivendell. And yeah, it was one of the happiest periods of my life. It was a real blossoming. I just loved doing what I was doing, you know, putting on retreats. I had a very creative sort of relationship with one of my fellow community members. We were both very much into myths and symbols, and we did a lot of retreats based on those sort of themes. He explored the five Buddha mandala. He did retreats on each of the jinnas, and I did retreats on all the themes from that Bhante draws out from the White Lotus Sutra. And it was quite bold as well. For the first time, I think we had five rhythms dancing on retreat. That seems a bit cutting edge. It was a bit, oh, dancing in the shrine room. But it really seemed to go well. It seemed, you know, dancing it seems a great way for people to really, you know, come out of themselves and relax and just blossom. Sorry to keep using that word, but it seems to be our experience, you know, a great way of just letting yourself out. I know, you know, Sangharsha has also used that image of, you know, what the Sangha is. It's a dance, you know, and we're, in some ways we're inviting people to join a dance. Okay, what else? Yes, well, then I had another disaster, if you like, in my experience of Sangha. I joined together with a group of others, and we went off to Rome to start a Buddhist centre. Again, so a highly idealistic, massive challenge. You know, we're all English. One of us had been there for a while, and you know, he'd started doing classes in Rome. So he wanted to get a team together, and I'd already formed quite a connection. Well, he was a very good friend of mine from the old days of Croydon. And I started getting this crazy idea of joining him, and we were going to start a Buddhist centre in Rome. It was a bit bonkers, really, but you know, I loved the sense of adventure. It was way out there, really, but very overambitious. I knew it was a tall order. You know, I went there, you know, with just tourist Italian. I could just about order a cappuccino and a pizza and that sort of thing. But I'm teaching English for the first time. I didn't have much money. You know, straight away landed. Within the first month, I was several thousand, if not, was it lira? Lira it was then, probably millions of lira in debt. And within a short space of time, we'd had a serious sort of disharmony within the community, which was incredibly painful. So there we are with this, you know, big project. We're going to, you know, take on the Vatican. We're going to convert Italy to Buddhism. But you know, we never got off. You know, we never got ground base established. Really, you know, we were fighting amongst ourselves, and that sort of carried on. But I had this weird sense, well, this is what I'm supposed to be doing. It was very strongly connected to a dream I had when I was ordained. I had a dream about being in Rome, having just been given this name. The very same night, one of the most vivid dreams I had, I was in Rome and I was embodying my name. So I thought, well, that's what I'm supposed to be doing. And that also coincided when I first visited Rome. I got off the plane, I think having travelled all night, not slept. I got off the plane, stepped onto the, you know, the thing you step on to go down. I just felt completely at home. Very strange experience, which I still don't understand. Anyway, I stuck it out for 6 years because I thought I was meant to be there. But I came back, you know, with absolutely, you know, with my dreams shattered. You know, having this strong sense of this is my calling. This is what I want to be doing. This is what I'm meant to be doing. And I came back, and again, I sort of collapsed. So a lot of, you know, my idealism has been tempered by some sort of harsh reality of trying to live it out. But I haven't given up. You know, I still believe in, you know, I want to do what I can to take Buddhism out, to take and invite people to join the dance, which is our Sangha. I've run out of time. Maybe one last thing. That my day-to-day experience, I think, of Sangha, you know, what's my main sort of way I plug into Sangha is through my chapter. As an order member, you may know this, we usually meet up in chapters once a week. And for me, being with those men in my chapter, there's Shanti Ghosha and Mahasiddhi here, and Jnanaketa up there, in my chapter, you know, well, these are my brothers. Shudakirti. You know, these are my brothers. And I had a lovely sense a few weeks ago. I was, you know, having, you know, very challenging time. And I decided, you know, I needed to speak and I needed a bit of help with what I was struggling with. And I remember, you know, the look on the faces of my brothers in the chapter was just one of love. You know, they really cared about me. And that, you know, if that's what the Sangha means to me, is being with people who I share the same spiritual aspiration. And in some ways, most importantly for me, they love me. And I love them. Is that enough? So I'd better leave it there because I've run out of time. Good. Well, thank you for listening. I hope it's been useful. I hope it encourages you to dance in the Sangha more and more. And show yourselves.